Hopefully.
Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live from Chicago.
Working man in internet radio is my father, George Wilder Jr., and here he is.
Oh, thank you for that. It's nice to be here. I'm glad you're with me. Glad you're podcasting and downloading and all that good stuff. And it always makes me feel good. And thank you for all of that kind words and everything else. And I'm just glad to be here. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting on Block Talk Radio. And from out of the city of Chicago, you know, I mean, the state of Illinois, what can I say? It's a great town. It's a great city. It's a great state. And we are in the third month of an Illinois shutdown. This is the third month. Okay. And there's no budget in sight. Everybody's blaming everybody. When I say blaming everybody, I'm talking about the Illinois legislature. The governor's blaming them, and they are blaming the governor. And we know who takes the blame. The governor takes the blame. He's the governor of the state. What goes wrong in the state financially, it's his fault. He cannot, I can barely say it. You know, I mean, I'm so astonishing that this man who's the governor of the state is trying to throw the blame on other people when he's the one that has refused to sign budgets that legislature crafted. It refuses to sign them because there's nothing in the budget about busting unions, making things harder for people. And he was on, the governor of the city, Bruce Rauner, which is, he's a total sly dog. You know, he gets on there, he looks all compassionate, even says that he feels sorry and compassionate for the people who are losing their jobs and the social programs are closing down, but he's blaming the legislature. It's his fault. Anybody with half a brain or one-third of a brain would know that it's his fault. Stuff didn't start happening until he bought his way into office. This didn't start happening overnight. It started happening with him and his cronies. And now he's trying to say he's all compassionate. He cares. The man doesn't give a damn about people. He just saying that for the stupids out there. He's saying it for the stupids. And there's a lot of stupid people are buying this stuff. But people, progressives, liberals, and independents, we are not buying it. We know what the problem is. I'm talking about this. Forever, on every episode, every show that I've done for the last 3 months, the first day that the state was officially shut down or they did not have a budget or not sign a budget, you know, I've been talking about this. And everybody in this state has been talking about this. People are leaving the state. People are leaving the city because of what? Mayor Emanuel wants a $500 million tax increase on everybody. And we're already, the Cook County Commissioner, the president of the Cook County Commissioner, she's already raised taxes. The state is going to eventually raise taxes. We are taxed up the kazoo. The business are leaving. People, residents of the city said they're leaving. They're tired of being taxed. We're tired of it. But they don't. They don't. They just push it anyway because they want us to pay for the damage that they've done, want us to bear the brunt of their mismanagement. It's not going to happen. People in this state, in this city, they're struggling to pay bills. Now you want to take more of what they do not have? That's crazy. In my estimation, they are driving people purposely from this state, and they don't give a damn. They know you raise taxes on people, goods and services, people are just going to drive out to the suburbs and get those. Get it cheaper, where it's cheaper in the suburbs. Now, where is that going to get you? If you having people neglecting the goods and services and they have to go out to the suburbs and buy it because they can buy it cheaper and buy more of it, then what you've proposed and what you've passed is just, you know, is not working. It's not working. And these politicians, these folks, they know this. They pretending like they don't know. They know it. They know you could go out to the suburbs to buy goods and services if the taxes are too high. We have the highest taxes in the nation. We have the highest taxes in Illinois in the history of the world. In the history of the world. And these people want to tax us more. Mortgages. Anything that you use a lot, anything that you need, anything that you utilize, they're going to tax it. It doesn't matter what it is. If you buy it a lot, if they know that you're going after it, they're going to tax it. If you drink a lot of soda, they're going to tax the soda. If you eat a lot of ice cream, they're going to tax that ice cream. They're charging our cell phones. Yeah. I guess that wasn't enough. Taxing your cell phones. Whether you have a contract or you have a phone where you're just buying minutes to put on your phone to use, you're being taxed. It doesn't matter. If you got a cell phone, you're using it, it's activated, you're going to pay a tax. Taxing you for everything. I mean, you go to the store to buy a 99-cent 2-liter pop, and that doesn't happen anymore, you're going to pay $100 and because of the added-on tax. I'm just giving an example. I know I'm probably not correct on that, but it's just an example. The example is correct. So it's just awful. These policies, and they're throwing the blame at someone else. Especially Rauner, Governor Rauner, and it is a mess. The guy does not talk to the people. He does not talk to the press. If he feels like he wants to talk, he'll come out by himself, isolated room where there's cameras. He's all alone, and he says his spiel. He says what he has to say, and then he leaves. That's how he operates. The legislature is saying that Rauner needs to supply some leadership. Saying that all along. He's doing a lot of executive authority things to get laws passed, but he is not doing a budget. The legislature had to do a budget, I believe, 2 or 3 days ago, a payment to keep some funds rolling to some of these vulnerable programs that people need. A lot of the programs have been eliminated. I don't know about senior programs or disability programs, but a lot of these programs have been totally eliminated. People are out of jobs. Some of these daycare programs, I know that. And some of the programs that are being paid for because of court orders. and being paid for because they're federal programs, nothing to do with the state unions. He is after unions. If he can't bust unions, if they won't let him bust unions or get rid of unions, he will not sign a budget. It's all about unions. Do in unions. He's got, and unless if he signs a budget, it has to be something in the budget that says he can bust unions. If there's nothing in that budget that says he can bust unions, he doesn't want a clean budget bill. It's like he's holding the citizens who need those social programs hostage until the legislature let him give him blanche to bust. He's like every other Republican governor around the United States. Their main objective is to tear unions apart. That's it. And they will hold the people of that state destroy unions. That's all he wants to do. He wants them to say, hey, wow, you want these programs funded? Then let me destroy unions. And that's not going to happen. He is not going to destroy unions. He can't. This is a Democratic and liberal and progressive town, and he's just another hick Republican who wants to destroy everything. The thing is, like I said, just said a minute ago, the guy, he was on television. I even saw him today. He was on television looking all passionate and caring. He did that. He really feels really bad about some of the programs that are not being funded. People aren't getting paid. They're working for nothing because there's a state shutdown. There's no budget. And he really feels really awful. Give me a break. Here, they're going to believe that. They're going to eat that up. But we know, but the majority of us know who are affected by this, we know that he's just blowing smoke up his rear. Okay? Smoke up his rear. The shutdown is now 3 months and counting. The longer it is in need of the programs that are still being funded, that are still out there. Everything is dwindling away. They're talking about January now before it may get signed. And it's crazy. A lot of the things, a lot of the programs have already been affected negatively. Starting them up again is going to be a task in itself. The thing is, this did not have to happen. We don't know what Bruce Rauner's motive is. Maybe his motive is to be president of the United States one day. That'll never happen. He's one of the worst governors in the state of Illinois that has ever been. Even some of the Republican governors, former Republican governors, have been telling Bruce Rauner, hey, we're a Democratic legislature here. Why don't you just sign a budget? And then if you want to talk about your union strategy, we can do that after you get a budget done. He will not buy it. There have been about two put on his desk. He turned them all. The legislature said they're going to craft another budget. He's going to say, I'm not going to sign it. And he will not. So my thing is, we have a majority in the Senate. We have a majority in the House in the state of Illinois. Why can't these guys override governor for the state, pull it out of the toilet that this guy has placed it in? What's wrong? Override him. I don't know why they will not do it. They have to do it, unless some, like, well, you have to think, some Democrats, I mean, some Democrats, they go over to vote with the Republicans. And I think that any time a Democrat go over and vote with the Republicans, that Democrat should be voted out. Because that's true. That's true. You have Democrats go over to the side and vote with the Republicans and against their own constituency. It happens. It happens all the time. But you know what? The Republicans, they're not going to go over to the side of the Democrats and vote with the Democrats. The Democrats cannot stick together. This is why a week or so ago, they lost on, you know, the union thing with Rauner. They gave Rauner a win to start busting unions. They gave everyone all together. Some guy was in New York, and some guy said he just didn't like it. You know? So, Democrats just fall the hell apart. That's why I stopped being one. I'm an independent. I can't deal with these cowards, these spineless guys. A couple of these guys, they were on PBS television, the ones who didn't vote, gave Rauner a win, these Democrats, trying to explain their stuff away. There's no explaining. You didn't vote. You didn't do your job. You should be voted out, period. There's no explaining. Don't come try to explain to me why you weren't there. That's why you are in the House of Representatives, to cast a vote. That's basically all you do. That's basically what your salary is amount to, for you to vote. You don't vote, you don't do your job as one block, like the Republicans. The Republicans are scoundrels, but they stick together. Even if they don't agree with what some of the things that Rauner is doing, they stick together because what? They have the same party. They are Republicans. The Democrats can't seem to do that. They got the bitch. And that's why they lose. They cannot stay together. They want fame. They want attention. They want to be in front of the mics. They want to be on television, on the Sunday shows, and PBS, and interviews and stuff like that. So they screw up. And the Republicans fold everything because they can't get their acts together. This is George Wilder Jr. of the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live from Chicago. I'm ranting and raving here. I'm scheduled to have a guest here today, Ms. Jaya Khamenei, an advocate. We're going to try and wait for her. But until then, I'm going to be ranting and raving, okay? This is George Wilder Jr. of George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live from Chicago. Say it again. 347-857-1162 is my number. If you want to call in, ask the author some questions once she gets here, if that happens. You never know. Just hopefully I won't have any internet breakdowns, because, you know, that happens. It happens. When you're on the internet, things happen. You know, could cause a malfunction in the internet system, or being online, you're just taking your chances anyway. But however, I do love what I'm doing, and I do love it passionately. That's why I'm here 4 days a week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 6. Write that down, make a marker of it, and check it out. It's a great show. And always check out some of my archive shows. You know, there's a lot there. And basically, they're all good. If it's my show, it's a good show. There is no doubt about that. Only listen to me. And if you can't listen, archive the show, podcast the show. You know, a lot of people do podcast the show. A lot of people do download the show, listen to the show on their computers, on their iPhones, on their tablets. Wherever you are, you can listen to the show. All you have to do is just go to www.talk.com/Twilder Jr. And there you are. You choose which show you want to listen to. You know, they're all there and they're all good and basically all informative. And it's entertaining. Okay. All right. Follow me on Facebook. Follow me on Talk Radio. LinkedIn. I'm all over the place. Twitter. Yeah, I'm right there too. So get the word out about the show. I want you to, excuse me. And you also can get the word out about the show. We're going to take a small break right here, and I will be back. Let me see. Stay with me. The George Wilder Show Air. Hey friends and fans, this is George Wilder Jr. of the George Wilder Jr. Show. You know, it costs a lot to keep this show airing. It takes time, preparation, and dedication, and most of all, it takes revenue. If you would like to donate to keep this show on the air each and every day, just about, go to www.georgewilderjr.com. That's www.georgewilderjr.com to help keep this important show on the air. Donate for a good cause. The cause of this show, my show, your show. This is the talk of our times. Thank you very much. All right, we're back. Thank you so much for staying. Thank you so much for listening and all that other good stuff you do. Okay, victory. Obama's got another victory. He always has a victory. And the victory is that his Iran deal passed. Obviously, and some people say that's a good thing because we don't need to be going into wars. Okay, and it is true. We do not need to be another war. Republicans want wars, and they just against anything that he is for. They against anything America is for. So I always tell people, support it, then you better look at it again. You really better look at it again. And it's not funny, but it's true. So he's got a victory, and Obama is looking for his legacy. I mean, he's got a year and a half, okay? He can't run again. Only two terms. Check out the Constitution if you don't know that. Only two terms. So he's looking for something people are going to grab onto once he is out of office. You know, he wants people to say, well, Obama did this, Obama did that. That's because Obama did it. He's looking for people to say things like that. So once he's out of office, he doesn't want you to forget about it. He wants you to know that he was once president, and these are the things that he has done and that he has accomplished. Okay? He's looking to be in the record books. He's looking. So he wants to make, you know, a splash as he leaves office. Oh, he will. He totally will, because there are some things that he's done, should have done. Okay? I mean, we voted for him twice. There's a lot of people who are disappointed in Obama on some things, but they applaud him on other things. You know, so you have to kind of stand in line, and you love victories because you love people who are winners. We want to be with winners. We don't want to be losers. So he's a winner on this Iran deal. And all it does is just is keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Iranians. Okay? And like I said before, the Republicans, they war. They want war. And they're just shouting and screaming in the halls of Congress how they didn't like this bill and how it wasn't good for America. I'll tell you what's not good for America. Republicans are not good for America. they are not going. These guys are buffoons. They're idiots. They're rich. They're white. They're old. And they just don't give a damn about people. When I say people, I mean the middle class people. Middle class meaning working class people. People who work every day to pay their bills. If you're rich, they don't care anything about you. Okay? Donald Trump is back at it. Can you believe he calls this woman, practically, he calls her, in so many words, he tells her that she's ugly. Okay, this is let me find here. Fiorina. She's also a candidate for, she's running for president. And this guy is, Trump is just something else. He is out of the box with this. He basically says, look at that face. Face. Would you vote for a face like that? I'm quoting Trump, talking about Fiorina. I mean, she's not the greatest looking woman, but, you know, I mean, but Trump is just, the guy's got something against women or just. Now, I saw her today on television, Fiorina, and you know what? She's got on more makeup. She's put on more makeup. Trump. I mean, Megyn Kelly, the commentator on Fox, he told her that she was bleeding down there, talking about a crouch. He denied it. Okay, all right. But he said some other awful things about women. You know, Donald Trump is not president. He's good for a joke or a laugh. He's a buffoon. He's a bully. He's trying to be a nice guy, but he cannot shed that bully in him towards other people who disagree with him. That's a threat. He'll come after you if he feels that you disagree with him or you saying something negative about him. He's going to fire right back at you. You know what? And he's going to win. Now, he called her unattracted. Look at that face. Would you vote for face like? He said something else. I'm going to find it. As soon as I find the whole quote, I'm going to get back to you guys. But he's a bully. I mean, he's. But you know what? He's a winner. He is outrunning all the other 16 candidates that are running for president in 2016. He's outpacing them. You know, he's dead on. There's no doubt about it. Trump, the doc's way of speaking, the way he talks about people, the way he and talks like a street thug, the guy is going to get the presidential nomination alongside Bernie Sanders, I believe, because Bernie Sanders, from my understanding, is dead even with Hillary Clinton in Iowa. I mean, Clinton had a 20-point lead on this guy in Iowa. All of a sudden, Bernie Sanders has pulled up alongside of Clinton. Clinton is in trouble. She has lost her lead in New Hampshire. She's totally in trouble, and I really don't think it's the email controversy. I just think it's Hillary herself because she doesn't really like to answer questions on certain issues. You know, she gets her money from corporations and big-time donors. However, his money, his contribution comes from just grassroots people like you and me. You know, $10 here, $5 there, $100 here, $250 there. He raises his money from ordinary people out on the streets. Hillary, her money comes from Wall Street. And she doesn't really like to answer questions. We still don't know where she stands on TPP. All right, this is George Wilder Jr. of the George Wilder Jr. Show, broadcasting live from Chicago. Thank you for being there. Thank you for podcasting. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for everything, all the nice things you say about the show. and me as the host of this show. I'm broadcasting live from Chicago. My number is 347-857-1762. If you want to call in, if you want to sit back and listen and just relax, this is the show for you. You miss a show, you will miss a hell of a lot. This is one. All right, let's go to the phones.
Hello?
Okay.
George?
Yep.
I have some knowledge. Good evening to you. Yes?
Okay, Jaya Kamadi. All right. Jaya, you're breaking up a bit. Is it on me?
I don't know. Let me call you back again. All right? Let me try that again.
Okay, she's going to call back. She's going to call back. It might be me. Okay. Jaya Kamadi, let me tell a little break here, and I'll be right back. We will find out. Let's see. All right. Stay with me. All right. Okay. The George Wilder Jr. Show broadcasting live from Chicago. Let's go back to the phones. All right.
Hello. Hello.
Oh,
George.
Wow. That's.
Hi.
Yeah.
This is Jaya Kamlani. Good evening to you and to your listeners.
Yeah. You are sounding a lot better.
I'm sounding a lot different. The phone was shaky
the first time, and you called back. It's a lot clearer. That's what I was meaning.
It's a lot clearer. Okay. Yeah, that's why I said I'll let me dial back again, you know. How are you doing?
Okay. Hi, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you so much for accepting it. And it's a pleasure to have on the show. And what have you been doing lately?
I published my third book this July, and that is a poetry book called Garden of Life. So I've published three books in 3 years.
Okay.
That's To India with Tough Love, Scent of Yesterday, which is my memoir, and the third is Garden of Life. And they're all intended to bring awareness and change to the world.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? The world needs changing.
Yes, that's true, and we can all help in our small ways, right? Yes. Since tomorrow is the anniversary of 9/11, I thought, and today is 9/10, so I thought, you know, it would be a good start to start off with a poem on 9/11, I thought. So whenever you're ready, we'll start off on that.
Okay, we're not going to start that now. I want you to talk about your book. Scent of Yesterday.
Okay, yes. And what would you like me to read, some passages from there?
Generally, give us an overall idea of what is the passage.
Okay, let me read the introduction to you so your readers are aware about it. Here's the introduction. Born by candlelight in August 1947, Jaya Kamlani, née Merchandani, and her family are among millions displaced by the partition of India. In Scent of Yesterday, she transports readers to post-British Raj Bombay with sweet and spiced vignettes of her youth, from riveting family tales and convent school capers to forbidden love. In 1969, Jaya gets an opportunity to study in America. With newfound freedom, she weds against her family's wishes and launches her career in the New York advertising industry. She later takes a leap into technology and fights the Silicon Valley glass ceiling while enjoying simple pleasures with her family. After retirement, she reflects upon her role in the world and writes about it. Scent of Yesterday is a prequel to Jaya's first book, To India with Tough Love. Her spirited candor and ceaseless determination inspire others to overcome their inhibitions and embrace the unknown. Readers will also cherish music, dance, and local cultures of yesteryears. Jaya Kamlani is an English literature graduate of St. Xavier's College, Bombay, now known as Mumbai. Basically that.
Is it a biography or autobiography?
It's a memoir. Yeah.
A memoir, okay. Okay.
Which flows like a novel, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it basically is about your life.
Right, right. Autobiography, I feel somebody else writes about it. Memoir is something
that I know.
That
I know.
I
didn't know
myself.
Because the introduction was like somebody wrote that.
Yeah, because you're supposed to write introduction in the third person. That's why.
Right, right. So I'm thinking, but everything else in the book is a memoir. Yeah, yeah. So give us a little tidbits about some of the things that's in the book that interest you. Some of the things that you've gone through in your life to get where you are today.
Well, I attended a convent school, which kind of disciplined me in life, and so did my parents. They really disciplined us in life, and studies were very important in my family. So if I came home with a bad grade, I got not just a slap on the wrist, I got beaten up with a ruler, you know, and that is explained in my book. Yes, I got beaten up, you know, and I would just cry and then, you know, my father was very strict about study, so we all had, you know, everybody in our family got educated. Mm-hmm. My brothers and sisters who came here, they all have their masters and all that. Mm-hmm. So, because that's one way to advance in life, really, if you have a good education. And then, of course, you know, our culture over there, I'm of a Hindu culture, so which is different from the Christian culture. So I would go to the church and pray at the Catholic churches with my Catholic friends. And then I'd come home and pray to the Hindu gods. So I learned to be very tolerant of religions and had friends of all religion. And that helped in life.
So why do you think this book is important to, you know, check out, buy?
Well, this is really an immigrant story and the struggles of an immigrant. And today we have such a crisis in the world of immigrants, people migrating to different countries and refugees and immigrants all over.
Yeah.
So I think they can all relate to the struggles I went through when we came here to America. Both my husband and I was not married there. As you can see, I came here and got married. But I was married to the same man. But we went through our struggles, and together we made it.
Okay. The target audience for this book is probably other immigrants who probably migrated to the country like you have.
Anywhere in the world.
Migrated.
It could have been West, but now it is anywhere in the world, right? Everybody's migrating somewhere or the other. And also women, women's struggle in life. You know, they're working two jobs at home and at work. So they were working mothers. And as well as Indians who live here. And those who live in the West, they want to know something about India. So the book is set in India as well as in America.
Okay, that's great. That's wonderful. Can you read an excerpt from it?
Sure. I got pretty far. After getting into the advertising industry in New York, then I got into technology, and I worked for 20 years in the field of information technology, and I had my own consulting practice. For 14 of those years, I had my own clients, so I traveled coast to coast. So let me read you one piece from a chapter called A Closed Mind. I worked for Tandem Computers, which is no longer there, and it was acquired by Hewlett Packard, and this was in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And I was hired as a senior systems analyst. And before I start reading, so let me give you a little background on this chapter, because it's a long chapter, and so you can understand what follows then.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a large manufacturing company in Silicon Valley, California. A month after I was hired in 1989, my hiring manager was fired. I thus reported to a new manager. From the very first week, this new manager showed his discriminating colors to me. Within a month after his hire, he brought in a friend from his old company and told me to look for another job. Since he had no idea what I had been working on and had not yet seen any of my work, I marched straight up to the personnel manager's office and complained about him. I also complained to my director, but to no avail. But I realized I was not alone. My manager gave the same treatment to my project leader, a long-time company employee. Then I realized he wanted to get rid of the older employees and bring in new staff so he could cash in on every person he hired. There were notices in the hallways offering up to $7,000 for referrals who were hired. And so I figured he was going to wanted to really cash and make money by hiring his friends over. So eventually I sent an email to the president of the company. And when the president of the company received my email, he sent out a survey to the entire division and, in fact, all over the company, and asking them to fill in a form of how they felt about the management and so forth. And then he had our department investigated by managers from another division. So every employee had to sit in with a manager from another division and explain what was going on. Now let me, and then weeks and days dragged by, and now I'll do a paragraph reading here. Days dragged by. Tensions between management and me continued to escalate. Rod, who is my manager, did not include me on projects, meetings anymore. When the situation became insufferable, I went through the company's official channels to file a complaint. Then I hit another snag. I learned that the entire chain of command, the director, the vice president, and the executive vice president of the department, had all flown in from the same cuckoo's nest. No wonder my grievances fell on deaf ears. They'd all come in from IBM, you see? And so weeks dragged by, and by now my spirits had sunk so low. So that's why nobody was listening to me. Now I'll read a long passage. Okay?
Okay.
Here we go. One afternoon, Rod, that's my manager, called me to his office and asked me to turn over everything I had been working on. Everything? I asked. Yes, everything. I also want you to write down the file names where your work can be found on the computer. With all my assignments whisked away from me, I was a soldier relieved of all my duties. I had no choice but to oblige, for he was my manager. Surely he could not be acting alone. He must have the director's support. It came as no surprise when Rod took credit for all my work. But his Machiavellian plot did not succeed. The business managers of several departments had been working with me for a long time on it. How could he conveniently stamp his name on my work? Did he have no sense of ethics? Did he think he had a free pass to lie and cheat his way up the corporate ladder? Nothing uplifted me these days, not even my favorite songs. Disheartened, I dreaded to go to work at the office. I walked to the water cooler for the third time, checked my email for the fifth time, and looked at my wristwatch for the tenth time. The hands had barely moved. The pink slip appeared to be inching closer. Any day now, it could be at my door. Then one afternoon, the director arranged a meeting between Rod and me at his office. As I knocked on the door, through the long glass panel, I noticed the two men deep in conversation. "Come in," said the director. I took a deep breath and braced for the worst as I entered the room and slipped into the chair beside Rod. Save for a short stack of documents neatly piled on one side, the desk was bare. A white writing board on the wall was wiped clean. A large window offered a view of a treetop and a crystalline sky. The director broke the awkward silence with a forced smile. "Well, Jay, they used to call me Jay at work." Rod leaned against the wall, arms crossed, with a look that said, I dare you to spill the beans. I felt his hostile eyes upon me. Any moment now I expected fireworks. It was time to spill my heart or forever remain silent. The expose may have been too much for Rod's ears. He smirked, he snickered, and then he snapped. "Why don't you go back to consulting?" His devious frown, his provocative remark, his audacity cut through me like glass. The air grew thick in the room. The match had been struck. The fires fanned, and I was one percolating cauldron. I had looked forward to an olive branch this afternoon. Instead, it turned out to be an all-out war. My jaws tightened. My ears burned. My cheeks felt flush. It was now my turn to let him know that I was not intimidated by him. Pulling myself together, I brushed aside my fears. Turning to Rod, I asked, "Are you telling me to leave the company again?" He fell silent, but showed no remorse. I summoned the courage to ask the director, who sat there with a poker face, "John, is this what you also want me to do?" "Do what?" he asked. "Do you also want me to quit the company?" "No, I didn't say that. He said it. Don't include me." John shrugged his shoulders, pushed his eyeglasses up, and then folded his arms. Sparks flew across the room. My eyes darted between the two men as if I were watching a ping-pong game. They exchanged esoteric glances. Aha, they think this is a game. But I'm not going to roll over for anyone. I'm not going to let them break me. I can handle these honchos myself, if I must. I have nothing to lose but my job. If it comes to that, then I can always bounce back and return to consulting. "It's true. Rod said it, not you," I said to the director. "But he said it on your behalf as well. You've been in on this with him right from the start. I brought these problems to your attention from day one, yet you continued to side him." Outside the second floor window, the leaves on the treetops swayed gently under the California sun. Just then, Rod rose from his seat, sulking. He excused himself and stepped out of the room, trying to avoid eye contact with me. I slipped off my chair as well, but the director beckoned me to stay. "Jay, I want to talk with you." I got that sinking feeling in my stomach again. "Jay, if I asked you what is the one thing you do not like to work on, what would you say?" Aha, this is a trap. Leaning forward, I rested my arms on the table, met his gaze, and said, "I was hired as a senior systems analyst. If you could assign me analysis and design work, I have no problem." "I'm trying to figure what tasks to assign you," he said. "What if I gave you a programming task?" Oh, he's rubbing salt on my wounds, but I'm not going to let him see me sweat. I had spent my time in the trenches. I did not have to stay there forever. Gathering courage, I let the word spill. "Then I would tell you it's not the job I was hired for. When I interviewed for this position, I was assured it involved no programming. If it had, I would have not accepted the job. If you really must know, the one task that I don't like being assigned is programming. I paid my dues long ago. I have no intentions to return to it and lose more sleep." "Why, did you lose sleep when you were a programmer?" He leaned his elbow on the table and rested his face on his hand. How was the man to know what programmers go through? Although both my manager and my director worked for technology companies before, they had a business background, not a technical one. "Yes, sir," said. "I had many sleepless nights, but those nights are behind me. I've moved on to other things." "Such as?" "Business analysis and system design. John, we don't stay in the same position forever. We grow." A soft gaze eased over his face, but I hesitated to let my guard down. The storm had abated for now. No olive branch, no pink slip either. I returned to my cubicle, sank in my chair, ran my fingers through my hair, and stared vacantly at the computer screen in front of me. The emotional drama in the director's office had left me reeling. I longed for a generous portion of a luscious blueberry-topped cheesecake. I glanced at the clock, hands on the clock. Oh, how slowly they moved. Okay, so let me tell you what happened then. After I had sent this, I have stopped reading. After I sent the email to the CEO and president, I was called in by the vice president, the executive vice president, and of course, nothing changed. But then, of course, as I read out the passage to you, they all came from the same cuckoo's nest, which was IBM. Still no change in my matters attitude. And so I'm going to end off over here with a note saying that I threatened the management that I would complain to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. And I did. But so the rest you can read about.
I think you did the right thing. Yeah.
Because I went up the ladder completely. I spoke to every management up the ladder, all the way then to the director, the vice president, the executive vice president, the general manager, and then finally the CEO, and nothing was happening. But fortunately, everything turned out. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it seems like they were after you. They were out to get you.
Yes, absolutely, because they were trying to bring in their own staff and get rid of the one that was there. And this was a global project and a very huge project. And there were quite a few of us working on the project.
But you know what?
Go ahead. Yes?
Things like that are happening today in the workplace.
Everywhere. And you know why I wrote that episode?
Because
everybody has gone through it at some place or another, at some employment.
I have gone through it.
Right. And so everybody can relate to it. It's like if I talk of my father's death or somebody's death, people who are, and I show my pain, the people, the readers will feel the pain. It's like an association with the reader. And they associate with that pain by thinking of their loved one they lost. Oh, right? When I'm reading about... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, when they're reading your book, it's like they're looking at themselves, you know, in the mirror.
Right.
Kind of.
Now, if you notice on Facebook, I had posted a passage about when I sent my children to India, and they were very little, okay? And I put them on the... Right?
Yeah.
I have, like... Over 80 comments, 82 some comments, and people on that posting have actually divulged information about themselves, their hardships they went through, you know, and not only they were empathizing with me, but it was a catharsis for them, and they were reliving their own difficult times, and that is the nice part of writing, you know. Yes, you can. They associate with you this way.
So what do you think can be done about things like that going on in the workplace? You know, things happening to people unfairly, like you said, people try to steal your ideas and call your ideas their own.
Yes.
I've had that happen.
Right. I've had that happen to me at a couple of places, and I brought it out to the senior management attention when that has happened. At another place when I was consulting, there was Ernst & Young people, and they were hired, and then they were being fired, the group. And so they had brought me in, and now they did not want me to stay because I was replacing two of their people. And so they tried to pass on my work as theirs. And I told the director of the department, I said, either they stay or I stay. You know, you have to decide which one. He said, no, they're on their way out. That's why I brought you in. They're on their way out. So you have to take it up to higher management. Chances are sometimes it's possible that you could be fired for that. And, you know, and because you brought
it
to the limelight, you exposed what was happening to you in your group.
You're a troublemaker.
In the management. Right. You're a whistleblower. basically.
So, like I said before, a lot of that is still happening. People are
right.
at jobs. They're getting an idea. They're getting treated badly by the supervisor, the managers. They're
right.
having their ideas stolen. They are
right.
being threatened, but they still have to keep. So how do you actually, and if you become a whistleblower, like you said, you're a troublemaker, and they can fire you for that. But how do you? And a lot of people who are fired from jobs like that, they wind up suing their employer. For unfair,
yeah, but you
yeah,
see, then,
firing.
But it's almost impossible to win such situation. Almost impossible. You're better off looking for another job while you're still employed, even though they're giving you a hard time. But you're still employed. You can find another job. Once they fire you, you can. It's hard to find
I've
another job,
people,
right?
I've known some people who have won their cases. You know, some of them
really?
Some were settled out of court.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Then you should pass on those lawyers' names to people so they can go along with those lawyers. You
it
know?
Can happen.
Use the same lawyers.
If you're unfairly treated, if you unfairly place and you have, you know, evidence, you have proof, you know, you
right.
can take these guys down. You can take them
right.
down. Because.
But you see, what do you go through? George, aren't you going through a lot of turmoil?
Yeah, but the majority of the time, if they're treating you badly, they're treating someone else in the workplace.
Absolutely.
That you work
Absolutely.
With badly, also.
Yeah, and you have to let HR
so
know, but
got
sometimes
plenty
HR...
Of, right,
yeah.
HR. You know, you never know. Human resources might be a part of it. Because a lot of these times,
yes, and,
managers...
And in this case, it was. In this case, HR was part of the whole team. They worked with them. So, you know, I had no choice but to go all the way to the top and then finally complain to the EEOC. Readers will find it's a very long chapter, you know. And, you know, there are some very sad moments and, you know, things that even your readers can associate. But what I'm saying is you have to bring to the attention right up front why continue being miserable on that job.
Exactly.
Either that or find
yeah.
or
yeah.
find a new job.
Okay.
I wanted to read another piece. Another piece. This is a typical immigrant's life because when immigrants go back to visit their homes, they don't know if it's the last time or they're going to see their parents, you know? So after, let me read this chapter. It's a long, not very long. After the heartrending 9/11 tragedy, it was time for another long
mm-hmm.
respite. The chapter is called
mm-hmm.
Mother Becomes Child. Okay? Mother Becomes Child.
Okay.
That December, Ranjit
okay.
and I took a 7-week vacation to India. Ranjit is my husband. Over the years,
oh, okay.
our traveling assignments and the stresses of life had created a distance between us. It was time for us to reconnect and see our families again before it was too late. During his visit to Mumbai, Ranjit stayed with his family while I stayed with my kin, which was only a mile and a half away. It was good to see my mother again, although like autumn leaves, she was withering away with time. The only glimpse she got of the outside world was a tall apartment building outside her window, some 200 feet away at Calf Parade. Confined to bed, she had aged faster, but she still had that twinkle in her eyes. At 87, she suffered from memory lapses. She repeated herself for the fifth time, but I pretended I heard her story for the first time. At times, she unleashed her troubles on the living maid, but it was not my mother's fault. She was in her tender years. In her heydays, she used to run an efficient household with 6 children, servants, and constant guests. However, on this trip, I was shocked. This part I'm going to skip because it's about my mother and I want to stay with my... this part that I'm skipping is about my brother. So let me get back to my mother's thing. Every night at my family home, the lights were turned out before the clock struck 10. With my inner clock still ticking to New York time, 10 hours behind, I was not ready to turn in for the night. So I sat in the living room and read until my eyelids grew heavy. As I slipped under the covers on the twin bed in my mother's room, Manga, my brother, broke into a coughing spell in the adjoining room. I rolled out of bed, went to his room, and gave him a tablespoon of honey. It calmed his throat, and I returned to bed. But then the dog fights outside the building broke the silence of the night and kept me awake. Mm-hmm. Half an hour later, my mother pressed the buzzer by her bed to summon the live-in maid. The maid walked into the room, turned on the lights, rubbed the sleep from her eyes, and attended to my mother. 15 minutes later, the lights went out. At times, it was almost 4 when I finally fell asleep. At 6:30, the doorbell chimed. The live-in cook answered the door. It was the milkman. Soon the maid and the cook were bickering. Indian music was blaring from the kitchen, pots clanking, crows cawing, dogs barking, and the building watchman yelling at someone in the compound a couple of stories below. A new day had dawned in the busy city of Mumbai. Fortunately, my family's apartment was set away from the road, and the balcony overlooked a park, else the street clamor and the constant honking of cars would have driven me out of my mind. Confined to my bed, let me clear my throat.
That's okay, take your time.
All right. Confined to bed, my mother's legs had become stiff and bent at the knees. I offered to rent a wheelchair and take her out. And take her out for fresh air
okay?
And sunshine. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm fine. Thanks. Let me have a sip of water.
Okay. Jaya Kumari on. George Wilder Jr. Show.
I'm back.
She's getting a drink of water.
Yes. Yeah, I had
okay,
it.
Okay, go ahead.
Confined to bed, my mother's legs had become stiff and bent at the knees. I offered to rent a wheelchair and take her out for fresh air and sunshine, but she turned me down. She said she could not straighten her legs. I told her I would make her outing comfortable, but that did not sway her mind. Guilt pangs nudged at my heart. I had not been there for her during her difficult years, while she had raised us with such loving care. When the day wore on her, I opened the cupboard where I kept a large box of assorted liquor-filled chocolates I had bought her from a duty-free shop at the Amsterdam airport. Mommy, which one will you have today? Like a child, my mother's eyes lit up as she gazed at the chocolates wrapped in colorful foils. Picking one, she carefully peeled the gold foil wrapper, bit into the neck of the chocolate bottle, and blissfully slurped the liquor until the nectar was gone. Then she put the empty bottle in her mouth, and she was one happy camper. A gentle calm slowly washed over her face. Moments later, she smiled, baring her teeth. The maid gave her a quick wash and change. Once I even trimmed her nails before the liquor effect wore off. Since my mother did not let the live-in maid comb her hair, it became matted. She only let the part-time maid who stopped by to launder the family clothes comb my hair and attend to her bed sores. While I combed my mother's scanty long tresses one morning, I asked the live-in maid to tell her a long story. Engrossed in detail, my mother did not realize I had cropped her hair short. Peter Pan short. The maid had to keep extending the story to hold her attention until I was done clipping. It was not until sundown that my mother realized her long gray locks were gone. A sad look crept upon her face. Baby, did you cut my hair? Yes, Mommy. Now your hair will not get tangled. She moved her fingers slowly through her short hair. Mommy, until I'm here, I will give you oil massage and your hair will grow back fast. So that's it.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for that. That was great. That was wonderful. Okay, a couple of questions.
Go ahead. I'm sorry I had to clear my throat in between.
That's okay. It's understandable. What has been the toughest criticism given to you as an author?
As an author?
Criticism given
well,
to you as
yes.
an author.
Yes, I'll tell you what happened. When I wrote my book, To India with Tough Love, people knew I was writing about it for years because it took me almost 7 years to write and get it published. But as when I published it, there were men from India, including journalists, who would leave me mm-hmm. comments on my posting, on my Facebook posting, telling me mm-hmm. not to come to India and not to try to sell my book in India.
Wow.
So I took that seriously.
That is tough.
Because, yes, mm-hmm. My book was published in June 2013. And the prior September, Salman Rushdie was threatened not to come to India because he was a keynote speaker at the literary the Jaipur Literary Festival, which is a very prominent festival in Asia. And he was threatened. Yes, and they said they would assassinate him if he came to India, and so he could not.
Yeah, I remember.
Yes, so he gave his speech, you know, via telecast. Mm-hmm. And then soon after that, they mm-hmm. started writing this to me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I know what happens in India. You have to take this very seriously. So there's a lot of corruption. And, you know, anybody can just make your history overnight. So since then, I have not gone to India, you know. I decided, even though my book was published and so many people asked me to come there, I said, there is no way I'm coming back to India.
Okay, what have been some of the best compliments you've gotten for your writing?
For my writing, they tell me that I touch people's hearts. The one like I've posted on Facebook, mm-hmm. you have many such moments in my center of history yesterday. When you read through it, I mean, mm-hmm. It will drive you to tears. And even in my book, To India with Tough Love, men have read the book over here in America. Several men have told me that mm-hmm. it has driven them to tears. So, I mean, and they said they normally don't cry when reading a book, but I was able to touch their hearts and make them feel that mm-hmm. they were part of the scene.
Mm-hmm. Okay, tell people where they can find you. Yesterday, I'm thinking about that movie. Okay. Sense of Yesterday, Tough Love from India.
Yes, right. Yeah. And also The Garden of Life, which was just published. They're all available on Amazon.com. Yeah, Garden of Life, which is a poetry book, and which is about the issues of America and war and peace. And these are the issues mm-hmm. of today, you know, war and peace. So I have written many war and peace poems, environmental poems, the corporate war in America, which is titled Enemy Within. And I read that poem on your last show in June.
There
are many such poems. Yes.
Yeah. It was great. It was great. Okay, Jim Lottie, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me
on
the show.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, Jaya Kamlani on a George Wilder Jr. show. I'm going to take a break right here. I hope I haven't butchered her name. Okay. All right, she was great. She was wonderful. She talked about her books, Scent of a Woman, Scent of Yesterday. I don't know how the book is called, Scent of Yesterday. And In the Garden and Tough Love from India. I mean, they're all great. She's a great writer. She's a great activist. She's a great book. All right? George. All right, we're going to take a break right here. Let's see what we can do. Take a break, right? Can we do this? Can we do this here? Okay, let's see if we can. Okay. All righty. George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Okay, she was... Okay, let's see what we can do. All right. That was Jaya Kamlani on the George Wilder Jr. Show broadcasting. I'm going to take a break and see if we can take a break. We just may stay here because there's so much to talk about. Okay, so Sonny Bratram, can't say race has nothing to do with this. Okay, he's the guy who was attacked by 6 policemen in New York because they thought he was a thug. They thought he was a thug. Somehow it didn't happen. It didn't happen. So he's looking for an apology, and I think that the police chief did actually apologize to him. So that's a good thing. That is totally great. And so this is George Wilder Jr. from the George Wilder Jr. Show. I'm having problems with audio here. Let's see if we can do something. Yeah, we're having an audio problem. Most of the time when we have an audio problem, you can't hear anybody. So what I do, we're going to shut down and call right back into the show. Okay, here we go. Let's see what we got here. Call right back into the show.